Pleasure again. I did it yesterday. I was totally knocked out by Broken Glory, and this is a work that has been in the making for a very long time. I eagerly awaited it. When I got it, I was not disappointed. And I just want to stress two things about it. One is the origination came from Ed's own political involvement, experience living through those times, watching the Kennedy campaign during a very high point of fervor in this country, and finding that he actually saw something in RFK that maybe many of the people that he was, his colleagues at the time, might not have. And so there was a feeling about Kennedy that comes across in this work that's very extraordinary. But at the same time, he was doing research on the family, his book about the Manson family, and there were cross connections that came through in some of the law enforcement people that he'd been talking to. And he'd been collecting, as is his wont, collecting material over decades and continuing to collect materials. And a big breakthrough came when they opened at UMass Dartmouth the RFK assassination archive. And that is a demonstration of what concerned citizens can do, because that archive is filled with material that people collected over the years, various people, involved, uninvolved, but concerned. And so the trove that came up in that archive added to Ed's own material, and he was able to go back into thinking through the poem and how to present that material in a way that would both be the material of a poem, really an epic poem of some kind, and also be very effective as a piece that one reads and hears. And so I'm not sure if it's going to be evident in a reading of this type, but as I mentioned last night, one of the extraordinary things for me about Broken Glory is the fact that there's a high compression at the beginning, some major events of Kennedy's life, but the bulk of this 300-plus page poem concentrates on the last day and then on the last hours. And what happens in there is that the perspective of everybody in that room at the hotel needs to be accounted for, so that one can see the complexity of what happened in those moments and how, the burden of history, the weight of history, can just hinge on some very quick events. Very quick events, and how to then slow them down and take them apart and try to figure out what motivations there were for various interpretations of the events, not even the events themselves. So anyways, it's a pleasure to again introduce Ed. It's an extraordinary book. Buy it, read it, give it to friends, and spread the word.
Thank you. Broken Glory. I worked on this book for over 40 years. I compiled 19 banker's boxes full of files on my researches. The rule is keep your files orderly and well organized so that you can use them and write from them almost any moment you choose. And so I'd keep alphabetical files and chronological files. And every time I interview somebody, I date it and describe the circumstances. Because when decades go by, files 30 years old can just lie there in disuse. And you have to keep things alive. You keep your files alive. So. And I discovered when I wrote my book on the Manson family that the original drafts were written with line breaks. And I had a typist turn everything into Gutenberg Bible, boxes. But they were written in flowing. So in 1976, I wrote an analysis of this called Investigative Poetry. And I began to write book-length poems. I wrote The Poetry and Life of Allen Ginsberg, 1968, A History in Verse. I wrote a biography of Anton Chekhov in poetry form. And then I wrote a nine-volume history of the United States, America, history in verse. So over the years, I was a member of the counterculture. And on the weekend before Robert Kennedy was assassinated, my band, the Fugs, played the Fillmore East in New York City. And one of our drummer called Robert Kennedy a quote, amphetamine Wolverine, unquote. And that was what the counterculture kind of thought of him. And so when I did my book on the Manson family, I became friendly with crusty L.A. homicide officers and learned that not all of them were right-wing nuts, but many of them were fairly liberal and were open to talking to a guy like me from the counterculture. And I learned from some of these people after my book came out that there was a possible connection between Manson's family and the Robert Kennedy assassination. And I put it in here, in Broken Glory, the assertions. And so then I had learned to be a compulsive file maker. And for the Manson family, there's like 30 banker's boxes full of stuff. And I began to make a sub-file on Robert Kennedy, and it grew over the years. And then for the 40th anniversary of his assassination in 2008, decided I would write a poem, based on my investigative manifesto, investigative poetry. So I wrote a poetry version of his life. And then coming into his 50th anniversary, I decided I would really pull out. Ramsey Clark was the Attorney General during the first part of the Robert Kennedy assassination investigation. And I grew to trust Ramsey Clark. He was a good, liberal, honest, really a good AG. And his FBI was charged by him to look into this. So I used in this book the Ramsey Clark early FBI investigation sheets for all the people in the Ambassador Hotel kitchen where Robert Kennedy was shot on June 5th, 1968. And I find myself, I'm the first poet in world history to convert FBI files into line breaks. So and why is Robert so? I began to study Robert Kennedy's life. I know he worked for Joseph McCarthy, and he was he didn't like his staff to swear, and he could be quite a disciplinarian to his staff. And I analyzed his life over a course of 30 or 40 years, and I realized that he was, if we don't allow people to change, we're up the creek. So Kennedy changed, and he became a supporter of labor unions. The auto workers were among his chief supporters. He, Cesar Chavez, he prayed with Cesar Chavez early in his campaign, and he was he was against the war. He came out against the war and stood up against President Johnson. And they had a bitter confrontation. And Kennedy told Johnson he wouldn't run against him if he would set up a high-level commission on the war in Vietnam, and Johnson refused. So Kennedy, the day of the My Lai massacre, although no one knew about it at the time, declared his declared himself for president. And I think that he was a remarkable American. He was forged in the civil rights struggle. He led a lot of the Justice Department activities to curb the hideous Freedom Rider burners. You know, 1961, they burnt those buses of Trailways buses going to the South, just trying to have a Coke and a sandwich at a bus stop. So he was a remarkable American. And the eye-opening, ever-growing challenge to halt the war in Vietnam, his stance against apartheid and unselfish activism for prosperity for all humans. And if John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy had not been assassinated, American history would have been on a much better course. We wouldn't have had a war. The war would have ended in early 69, and 24 or 30,000 young American soldiers would have lived out their lives, and maybe a million residents of Vietnam and Cambodia and Thailand, you know, wherever the U.S. dropped its defoliants and napalm. So American history was twisted and torn by the assassination of Robert Kennedy. So I had a friend that worked with me on another book named Rick Veach, who's a good comic artist, and I asked him if he would do the illustrations to Broken Glory, and he agreed. So the illustrations by Rick Veach are quite outstanding. So I will read the final section of Broken Glory. Kennedy had campaigned really strongly and basically wore himself out. The final night of his campaign, he nearly passed out at the final rally in San Diego. And then he was flew back to L.A. from San Diego, and the singer Rosemary Clooney sat with him and Ethel for his final plane ride. And he went out to the beach house of John and John Sledge in Malibu. And John had been the director of the Manchurian Candidate. He spent his final day. And then he got antsy, and he wanted to get to, he got to CBS the afternoon of June 4th. The CBS broadcasters tipped Kennedy off that early precinct votes showed that he was beating McCarthy. So Kennedy put on his suit and tie and asked to be brought into the Ambassador Hotel, where his operation was headquartered. He had a suite on the upper floor. And he was sitting with his staff, and they got a call from Mayor Daley of Chicago. Now, Daley was terrible that year. You know, he caused the riots in Chicago. But early in the year, he still was a very powerful Democratic broker. And Kennedy, he called Kennedy before Kennedy went down to give his acceptance speech. He called Kennedy to congratulate him. And Kennedy looked over at Ted Sorensen, at his staff, and they all realized that they could win in Chicago because Mayor Daley was now in favor of Robert Kennedy. Before, Daley had begged Robert Kennedy not to run. And then now that Kennedy had won, you know, over 130 delegates from California, Daley called. So the Kennedy suite toward midnight was packed with favored friends and campaigners. Just before going down to the ballroom, speaking with close assistant Richard Goodman, he whispered that he thought they should tell Senator McCarthy if he should withdraw and support him, quote, I'll make him Secretary of State. In the final minutes in his suite, he chatted with Bud Schulberg and some of his staff on what to say in his victory speech. Then Kennedy was speaking with civil rights hero John Lewis. Wait for me, Kennedy said to Lewis. I'll be back in 15 or 20 minutes. To John Lewis, RFK looked so happy, quote, he could have floated out of the room. An attorney named Anthony Akers, former ambassador to New Zealand, was a key aide to the campaign. And when RFK decided it was time to go downstairs, Akers checked on the routine to follow the Get to Senator downstairs and to the podium. And as an FBI report states, quote, they took an elevator to the basement of the hotel, walked through a passageway to a freight elevator, and up the freight elevator to the room where to the floor wherein the ballroom and the podium were located. In the area of the serving kitchen, Robert Kennedy shook hands with a few of the hotel employees. During his California campaign stops, those who killed him must have seen how Kennedy went to the ballroom or where he always took a freight elevator to the basement and then up another freight elevator to the ballroom. He did that three or four times. He did it, you know, and he did it the night before in San Diego. He went down the freight elevator and up. So it was a pattern. As he led RFK to the victory podium, Akers told the candidate that after his speech, in the words of the FBI report, quote, that he was going to clear a path so that when he, Kennedy, left the podium, he could go to a ballroom on the floor below where there was a crowd of people. He told Robert Kennedy to go to the left when he left the podium, and Kennedy agreed to this. RFK had a gulp of ginger ale, scanned himself in the mirror. Then he was urged to go down. As he left, he asked that Al Lowenstein, organizer of the 67 Dump Johnson movement, be telephoned in New York to say that RFK would call him right after the victory speech. RFK used the same path downward as back in Oregon and recently in San Diego, down a hotel elevator to the basement, then up in a service elevator to the kitchen, and then through the kitchen and up to the stage for his victory speech. He encountered his 11-year-old daughter, Courtney, and paused a couple of minutes asking her what her day had been like. Then he went down the freight elevator and through the kitchen and up an enclosed stairway and onto the utterly packed stage overlooking the overflowing embassy ballroom. Kennedy walked onto the stage with Doris Huerta, co-founder with Cesar Chavez of the National Farm Workers Association, and escorted by Olympic decathlon champ Rafer Johnson and pro football star Roosevelt Greer, plus, of course, Ethel and some of their children. The applause and excitement was enormous. There were jubilant young men in Kennedy straw hats and women in white blouses, red Kennedy sashes, and blue skirts. It was a time of playful joy. And wow, was the stage crowded. The winner first congratulated Don Drysdale of the Dodgers, who just won a three-hit shutout. He thanked those who helped him. It was very, very hot in the ballroom. The speech would run about 12 and a half minutes. The path RFK was supposed to take after the speech. He was supposed to walk down the steps off the left side of the stage and down through an enclosed stairway to address the crowd, an overflow crowd, in the embassy room one floor below. The FBI interviewed William Gardner, chief security officer at the Ambassador Hotel, who awaited RFK with two security guards at the bottom of the enclosed staircase from the embassy room that RFK was supposed to take. FBI report, quote, shortly after midnight on June 5, 1968, Gardner was located in the foyer on the ambassador room just below the bottom of the inside staircase. With Mr. Gardner were two security guards. A Kennedy aide had requested them to be there because RFK were to, quote, come down the enclosed stairway and go to the ambassador room to talk to the people located there. Then, a plan to talk with the pencil press. Key RFK aide Fred Dutton interrupts and changes RFK's stage exit plan. Of course, without telling RFK. FBI report. After the senator had completed his victory speech in the embassy room, he was preparing this ambassador vice president named Uno Timanson was preparing to lead the senator down to the ambassador room through the enclosed stairway. And just before the senator's speech was completed, Fred Dutton, one of the senator's aides, asked Timanson if there were television sets in the ambassador room. And Timanson told him there were. It was then decided that the senator would visit the press room instead to make a press release. Timanson escorted the senator and his party through the hallway behind the embassy room and into the pantry area. So the decision was made by Kennedy's staff without telling Kennedy, apparently on the moment, to do a session with the pencil press. His security guys were an ex-FBI agent, Rosie Greer, tackle for the L.A., whatever it is, the football team there, and Rafer Johnson, a decathlon champion. Those were his three bodyguards, and they were peeled off. The first rule, if you're being guarded by people, don't get peeled off from your guard. And this decision for Kennedy to go off the stage in a different direction, that he wasn't even prepared to knew himself, his bodyguards were leading Ethel and the children and everything off of one thing, and a person said, this way, Mr. Kennedy, you'll see in a minute. His security guards were prepared to take him to the pencils by side steps off the stage. Fred Dutton told the FBI that Kennedy did not know that his route leaving the stage was being changed. So his three bodyguards were on one side. Meanwhile, Siran Siran was taken by a woman in a polka dot dress to the ante room by the stage just behind where RFK is speaking. Harvard professor Dr. Daniel Brown, in a report in 2011, after 60 hours of interviewing and hypnotizing Siran Siran, stated that Siran was led to a room off the stage while Kennedy was giving his 10-minute victory speech. Quote, the woman in the polka dot dress then took Siran by the hand and led him to the ante room behind the stage where Senator Kennedy was speaking. There they found some coffee, at which point Siran begins to feel attracted to her. Quote, it was my job to woo her, unquote. When all of a sudden, according to Dr. Brown, quote, they are interrupted by an official with a suit and clipboard. This official tells them they cannot stay in the anteroom for security reasons. And the official then tells the girl in the polka dot dress to go to the kitchen. Siran to Dr. Daniel Brown, quote, all of a sudden they tell us we have to move. This guy comes by wearing a suit, darkish hair, a big full face. Seems like he was in charge. He wasn't wearing any uniform, wearing a suit. She acknowledges his instruction. He motions toward the pantry. The guy says, you guys can go back to this room. I followed her. She led. I was like a little puppy after her. But she went straight to the pantry area. With my being so attracted to her, I was just glued to her. Siran was clueless. She and the official led him to the very place that the assassination was to occur. RFK's victory speech was just long enough to get the kill team surely in place. The patsy, Siran, seen by witnesses on top of a tray stacker with the woman in the polka dot dress. His final speech. After adjusting the microphones and a fairly lengthy list of those he thanked for their help, Kennedy spoke for approximately 10 minutes, well enough time to get what I call the robo team. You know, I think these CIA employees hypnotized and programmed Siran with alternative memories to kill Robert Kennedy. Anyway, just enough time to get the robo team in place. After congratulating Don Drysdale for his sixth straight no-hit shutout, the winner of California's 178 delegates, relaxed and smiling, thanked his wife Ethel, Rosie Greer, Rafer Johnson to great applause, and thanked the great support of black voters and the support of unions, specifically thanking the United Auto Workers, Paul Schrade, on the stage with him. He congratulated McCarthy. He pointed out that the, quote, country wants to move in a different direction. We want to deal with our own problems within our country, and we want peace in Vietnam. And there was great applause at that. He was looking forward to, quote, a dialogue or a debate, unquote, with Humphrey, quote, on what direction we want to go in, what we are going to do in the rural areas of our country, what we are going to do with those who still suffer within the United States from hunger, and whether we are going to continue the policies that have been so unsuccessful in Vietnam. Then he finished. What I think is quite clear is that we can work together in the last analysis, and that what has been going on within the United States over the period of the past 3 years, the divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country, an unselfish country, a compassionate country, and I intend to make that my basis for running. And there was great applause. RFK flashed a brief V sign with his hand, then left the podium. The crowd chanted in a powerful rhythm, "We want Bobby, B, we want Bobby." Behind RFK by the curtain, leading back to the ramp, directly to the killing zone, a voice spoke, "This way, Mr. Kennedy," and a hand took him back to the rear of the podium while his bodyguards were off to the side waiting for him. First rule: don't let yourself get peeled off from your guards. So all three of RFK's guards, including Bill Berry, prepared to clear a pathway for RFK, Ethel, and children to proceed down the steps, stage right, toward the colonial room, instead of the enclosed stairway leading to the downstairs ballroom RFK were originally going to take. So RFK, a hand, and it's, I have not been able to find a tape or any proof about the voice on this tape that said, "This way, Mr. Kennedy." But it wasn't anybody that has volunteered to say that they were the one. Somebody said, "This way, Mr. Kennedy," and he acted first to go off to the left with Ethel, but then he was pulled back through the curtains, all alone in the back and down. There was a young woman named Lisa Urso, a high school student in San Diego, who was standing by the door of the pantry as RFK entered the pantry. He went down the back, through the back of the stage, down a ramp, and down into the back entry to the pantry in the kitchen on the other side of swinging doors, where Ceron was waiting on a tray stacker with the woman in the polka dot dress. Lisa Urso was standing by the door of the pantry as RFK entered the pantry. Suddenly, she was shoved from behind, and a young man pushed in front of her. I thought it was going to be a waiter, and it looked like he was trying to get in there to shake the senator's hand, only it was Ceron Ceron. She saw a flash from the gun. Lisa Urso also spotted another person, a blonde wearing a gray suit with a gun in his hand. It was not Ceron and not wearing a uniform. ACE, RFK researcher Philip Melanson, whose archive is at the UMass Dartmouth right now. ACE RFK researcher Philip Melanson interviewed another witness, which he listed under a pseudonym in several books, who saw a guy with dark wavy hair and a gray suit shoot his gun once or twice and run out of the pantry. He was seen earlier with Ceron in the evening. As I said, Ceron had been spotted by an ambassador waiter standing on a metal table with a woman wearing a polka dot dress. Ceron and polka dot were talking, then Ceron dismounted the table. Yet as he fired at RFK, Ceron thought he was shooting at circled targets at a firing range. From Dr. Daniel Brown's hypnosis sessions with Ceron, quote, Mr. Ceron was led to the kitchen by a woman after that same woman had received directions from an official at the event. Mr. Ceron did not go with the intent to shoot Senator Kennedy, but did respond to a specific hypnotic cue given to him by the woman to enter, quote, range mode, during which Mr. Ceron automatically and involuntarily responded with a flashback that he was shooting at circular targets. Ceron to Dr. Brown. When he and Polka Dot arrive in the kitchen, quote, I'm still sleepy, very sleepy. I was flirting with her. The place was darkish. We were the only ones in that area. I don't know where the hell it was, a deep place to get romantic with that girl. Then she sat up on the table facing with her back to the wall. Her thighs and legs are right there. I'm looking at her, trying to take her beauty in. I'm trying to figure out how to hit on her. That's all I can think about. She sat on the steam table. I was leaning. I was fascinated with her looks. She was sitting. I was standing. I was engrossed. She never said much. It was very erotic. I was consumed by her. She was a seductress with an unspoken availability. Ceron to Dr. Brown. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to have her. All of a sudden, she's looking over my head toward an area. Then she taps or pinches me. It is startling. Dr. Brown then asked Ceron what exactly he remembers after she tapped, or pinched him. Ceron, it was like a wake-up. The contact with my body. This is too abnormal for people to pinch like that for no given reason. It was like when you're stuck with a pin or pinched, a very sharp pinch. I thought she did it with her fingernails, like a wake-up. It snapped me out of my doldrums, yet I'm still sleepy. She points back over my head. She says, look, look, look. I turn around. I don't know what happened after that. She spun me around or turned my body around. She was directing my attention to the rear, way back. There are people coming through the doors. I'm still puzzled about what she is directing me to. It didn't seem relevant to me. Some people started streaming in. She kept motioning toward the back. Then all of a sudden, she gets more animated. She puts her arm on my shoulder. I think she had her hand on me. I am not sure if it was her hand or somebody else's. Then I was at the target range, a flashback to the target range. I thought I was at the range more than I was actually shooting. at any person. Three drawn weapons. Cirons, a guard, Caesar, Thane Eugene Caesar, and a tall man in a suit. In the words of excellent researcher Philip Melanson, in addition to Ciron's gun and that of security guard Caesar, Lisa Urso saw another one. During our interview, she clearly recalled someone she assumed to be a security guard drawing a gun. She sighted the gun immediately after the shooting, just as Ciron's gun was wrestled from him. A second witness, this is Philip Melanson, whom we shall call Martha Raines, told the author of seeing a man fire a gun in the pantry. He was approximately 6 foot 2 inches tall, Caucasian, with dark wavy hair and wearing a suit, not a uniform. Raines had seen the man standing near Ciron earlier in the evening. She believed that the man constituted a sinister presence in the pantry and was not protecting the senator. According to Raines, the man fired a handgun of some kind. She recalled that the gunman was not composed. He didn't shoot more than once or twice before running out of the pantry. And then Philip Melanson also interviewed a freelance photographer named Evan Freed, who had stepped inside the pantry to repair his damaged camera when he heard shots. And Melanson notes that Evan Freed was by then a photographer in the employment of a newspaper. Later, he became a L.A. city attorney, Evan Freed. And he saw, after the shots, and he was trying to repair his gun, he got knocked and fell to the floor. And he struggled to get his balance. And he saw three people, two men and a woman, running to the exit at the east end of the pantry. Freed sees a second man aiming a gun. He was about 4 feet away when shooting started. Freed, quote, I saw the second man wearing darker clothing who had been in the pantry with Ciron during the speech, pointing a gun in an upward angle at the senator. Based on the sound I heard, I believe the first shot came from this man's gun. Freed, quote, in the background, I could see Ciron firing a revolver held in his right hand in the direction of the senator. People in the crowd were screaming and grabbing Ciron. Freed further states in a sworn affidavit to Philip Melanson that people rushed towards Ciron and passed the second gunman who was backing away. And right away, Freed viewed the second shooter running in his direction, chased by another man who yelled, stop that guy, stop him. So there were 13 witnesses seeing Ciron and a woman in a polka dot dress. And the second gunman was seen by three witnesses, which I list in my book. And Coroner Thomas Noguchi's account of the three bullets in RFK. There were three bullets, one of which killed RFK, that hit him in the back. Ciron was on the front, never more than 3 or 4 feet, and did not go behind Kennedy. The first shot went through Kennedy's armpit. The second shot lodged in RFK's spinal column. And the third bullet, which killed him, was shot from a half inch or an inch from his right ear in an upward direction, showing the assassin was sliding up, and he shot RFK in his right ear, and that was the bullet that killed him. And in my book, I go into some of the fudging of the ballistics on the part of the L.A. police authorities. The bullet that killed Robert Kennedy was initialed by Noguchi, TN. But the bullet that was later alleged to be the bullet that killed RFK didn't have, somehow it lost the initials TN, and they was substituted. In other words, they fudged around and substituted the bullets because they had to keep the number of bullets down to 8, which were what were contained in Ciaran's pistol. And there was a Polish reporter named Stanislaw Przyszynski who covered that the shooting and didn't know there was going to be a shooting. He covered the victory summit. The hotel was way above fire code. There were probably 10,000 people crowded in to celebrate this wonderful victory. It was just like the biggest, like the Beatles were there. It was just packed and packed. So Przyszynski was covering the victory primary for the Montreal Gazette, and he happened to have a tape recorder running during the shooting. He later gave his tape to the California State Archive, where the Przyszynski tape remained unexamined for a number of decades. Finally, a CNN reporter found the tape and had it examined and had it digitally remastered. And forensic examiners contend that at least 14 shots were fired in the kitchen pantry in a burst of pop, 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 pop. And then the issue I found in FBI reports was Ciaran firing blanks. A source in LAPD had said that Ciaran was firing blanks. It sounded like a cap pistol or somebody cracking a balloon, said a former assistant attorney general under LBJ. And the hotel employee who had been leading RFK through the kitchen told the FBI, "I, at the time, I didn't recognize what it was, and I saw some paper flying. I don't remember what it was, paper or white pieces of things." Rafer Johnson, one of the bodyguards, rushed to be at RFK's side, but was too late, but said, "I looked, and then when Ciaran kept firing, I saw smoke, and I saw something coming from it like a residue from a cap. And it looked like a cap gun throwing off residue." Because it would make sense for the kill team to... There's also FBI reports that I cover in my book about Ciaran went target shooting the afternoon before the killing. And one person remembers that Ciaran practiced, shot off blank bullets during his target practice. So it would make sense. I mean, if you have two assassins and one a crazy program guy shooting, you would want him to not be able to kill the assassin. You know, you got a guy shooting right from behind RFK's head and everybody, you know, and so there were other victims, but the key to it is the fatal bullet fired at less than 1 inch, according to Thomas Noguchi's autopsy, and Ciaran possibly firing blanks no closer than 3 to 5 feet from Kennedy. Juan Romero kneels by Robert Kennedy. Working in the kitchen and the pantry was young Juan Romero, who wanted to shake Kennedy's hand, as he had the night before when he delivered a cart of food to Kennedy's room. So Romero went to the pantry, and I knew he was about to leave the embassy room, and they would pass through the hallway near the kitchen. I had shaken hands with Senator Kennedy on two previous occasions. I took a position in the hallway just in front of the opening that leads to the kitchen. There were approximately 15 to 20 people in the hallway. Senator Kennedy came through the door accompanied by approximately 5 men. He seemed to recognize me. I was smiling, and Senator Kennedy was smiling. He held out his hand, and I shook it. Senator Kennedy kept walking for approximately 1 or 2 steps. Then he heard gunfire. I observed Senator Kennedy placing his hands to his face, and he staggered backward a few steps and slumped to the floor. I knelt on the floor at Senator Kennedy's left, and I placed my right hand under his head and slightly lifted his head. At this time, I felt blood on my right hand. I said, "Come on, Mr. Kennedy, you can make it." His lips moved, and he seemed to say, "Is everybody all right?" By then, Ethel had rushed to the scene and pushed Ron Romero away. Romero asked if he could give Bobby his rosary beads. I pressed them into his hand, but they wouldn't stay. So I tried, wrapping them around his thumb, and when they were wheeling him away, I saw the rosary beads still hanging off his hand. Robert Kennedy, he fell down. He fell down by the ice machine, by the ice machine. Oh, won't somebody please tell me why the guns only point to the left? It wounded the nation in countless ways, wounded her history the rest of her days. Oh, it wounded the future like Lincoln Amort or Roosevelt's sinking and the A-bomb's retort. Oh, tell me again why the guns usually point to the left with gunpowder ballots and voting with knife heft. Never for peace, always for strife, empire and war. A dollar a life. Oh, Robert Kennedy, in the time torrent tossed, Robert Kennedy, by the ice machine lost. Alone we weep, alone we mourn, alone, as Sartre once said, with no excuses. Robert Kennedy, he fell down. He fell down by the ice machine. By the ice machine with the rosary in his hand, he lay by the ice machine. By the ice machine. Thank you. Well, it's great to read in this wonderful, I remember Vincent, visiting Vincent here. Nice place, good vibes.
Hey, do you think it was normal to hire sports celebrities as your personal bodyguards? That's why did you do that, you know?
Well, Kennedy was, he would have, during the campaign, he would have Sunday brunches with Hollywood people like, you know, Hollywood stars, you know, and they would say, "Don't you afraid of getting assassinated?" But he would say, you know, he was a devout Catholic. You know, he believed in fate. You know, he says, and he was warned. You know, but the mayor of L.A. hated his guts, so the L.A. police would ticket Kennedy's campaign caravans if they tried to run a light. You know, he was, wherever he was, there were tens of thousands of people would come out of their apartments and out of their houses to surge to be able to try to touch him. Wherever he went in California, there was thousands of people would show up. So he would, if in L.A., if his caravan tried to run a light, the LAPD would ticket the offenders. So he... when I have it in the book, you know, there's two or three times where they warned him, you know, but he kept telling people that he was going to open up his brother's assassination files. See, and he told enough. I annotate in my book a bunch of incidents where he tells people that he's going to, like, important people, elected people. And if somebody like Robert Kennedy says they're going to open up John F. Kennedy's assassination investigation, that's going to, the CIA, you know, Langley's going to know about that very soon. And so it would have been better for Kennedy to say, "Look, I accept the Warren Commission report. I'm not going to do anything." But he was so overwhelmed with anguish about what happened to his brother that he wanted to get those people that killed his brother, and that probably fed the determination. You know,
they didn't ask him to wear like bulletproof stuff under his suit. Or?
He could have had. he didn't want Secret Service protection. You know, after Martin Luther King was,
he probably trusted them less than. I mean, probably didn't trust the Secret Service.
He was divided. He said there were good CIA guys and bad CIA guys. His wife's husband, his wife's brother-in-law, it was a top-ranked CIA guy. So, I mean, he said there were good CIA people and bad CIA people. And he... I don't know. He had the point is that those people who killed him, all they had to do was peel off his three bodyguards. They were going off in one direction, and a strange hand takes him through the back of the curtain. He's all alone, and there's this crazy guy being wired up by the. She's very pretty. She has probably a Marilyn Monroe wig on. You know, they got this woman in a polka dotted dress, designed to, because Ceron probably never. Made it with a woman. He probably was a virgin, you know, and so this beautiful woman was coming on to him, you know.
Did anyone else get arrested besides Sirhan, or all the attention was on him and everyone else?
Yes,
away?
Because they had the gun, they had a smoking gun.
With captatretis coming out of it.
And but enough people in the FBI reports I cite in my book, there's enough indication that he there was firing a starter pistol, firing gun, you know, spitting out residue rather than bullets. And there are people who investigate Ceron's activities, and they've discovered that at the shooting range, he tried. blank bullets. So he may have had blank bullets in his gun from returning from the pistol range where he did, you know, they always get him to go target hunting. Target, you know, so Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, I mean, the standard operating assassination procedure. Get your mark to shoot a gun in the afternoon before he tries to.
You mentioned a woman named Candy Jones who was brainwashed earlier. Is there any relation between her and the polka dot dress woman at all?
Who?
Candy Jones.
Candy Jones was in Philip Melanson's archive at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, is a tape of Candy Jones talking about being in the same hotel that Robert Kennedy stayed at in San Francisco the night he did his debate with Senator McCarthy on June 2nd. And she describes the person with a Viennese accent, whom we think was the main programmer of Sirhan, being in the lobby. And also, he's the one that they think that Rosie Grier was also worked on by these robo-programmers. So Rosie Grier, anyway, so it's in my book. But anyway, thanks to Judy Farrar, who's the librarian of the RFK Archives at University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. She bent over backwards to provide tapes for me and hundreds of pages of Sirhan Sirhan's medical records, and she opened up Philip Melanson's archive to me and gave me stuff way beyond probably her job description. So I'm grateful.
Why did you go to Dartmouth? That's sort of a remote
because
campus.
That's where history has a way of boinging in on us, you know. Yeah. It's hard to know. Philip Melanson taught there. They needed all these. This was 50 years ago, Robert Kennedy. Most of the people who early on carried the torch. There were 20 or 30 or 40 investigators of the RFK assassination who developed, like I do. I have like 23 boxes, but I mean, some of these people probably have 30, 40, 50 boxes. So Philip Melanson, I think, was on the faculty at UMass Dartmouth, and he was an impressive figure, very good writer, and, you know, very good at administration. And he developed a system. He got the California State, all the FBI records, all the California State files on RFK were transshipped and sent to Dartmouth. And it's there. And they've got a really good librarian. It's very neat. You can access wonderful stuff. And it made I wouldn't have been able to do my book without UMass Dartmouth.
So Madison's not alive anymore.
No, he died a long time ago, you know, in 2006 or 2008, somewhere.
Okay. Was there ever any connection found between Al Lowenstein and Kennedy, the assassination when Al was...
Well, Al was bumped off under strange circumstances by that guy. I don't know. Yeah, people said he was a liberal CIA. It goes to what I think they do now. I have relatives that have been recruited by U.S. military and military. They're all, you know, they're like liberals. You know, they don't care about certain aspects of your act, as long as you obey on certain acts, certain points. So I don't know. When I have a relative, I know that, you know, gets a job with Naval Intelligence, there's nothing I can do about it. You know, I just, you know, I just, you know, stay cordial.
Oh, that's a problem.
Well, yeah.
Can I ask you, do you know Peter Dale Scott?
I know of him. I've met him. I've appeared at, you know, various events where he is. Yeah, I have a lot of respect for his writing and his...
Well, he has a lot for yours, too. I mean, I think...
Yeah, so I think he's really a first-class historian, but also a writer. He writes long poems, and he's...
And they're investigative, and I was thinking of them because I wrote about them once, so I know them. I was thinking about his saying once that, you know, I think somebody said, why do you write these as poems? You know, why do you put in the line breaks? Because he has these vast bibliographies of, you know, very technical sources, and so he quotes from them constantly. And he said, well, because people he knew had been writing about these things in prose had been running into bad ends.
I didn't think of that.
Well, and I mean, he's more paranoid than you are, but he said in poetry, and of course it's had a huge effect as poetry, as it turns out. He said in poetry, you can get away with
crazy poet
anything.
Yeah.
But of course then it was that the filmmaker Josh Oppenheimer learned about Jakarta and the massacres in Indonesia during the mid-60s and made his movie that won the Oscar. In other words, poetry is a highway towards aftermaths and consequences, because I think, like, when you reveal things like this, there need to be consequences, huh?
Well...
Or do you just think it's important to have the record?
When I was young, I tried to board a Polaris submarine to pour salt water on the nuclear missiles.
No kidding.
So I led an exorcism of the Pentagon in 1967, you know, right there in the Citadel of Powers, shouting, out demons, out, out demons, out. I don't know. No. Paul Goodman says, in America, you can do anything you want, say anything you want, as long as it doesn't have any results. So after I get film crews coming from Finland and Sweden who want to talk about the exorcism of the Pentagon. But I tell them, you know, the war went on for 7 more years. So I have to say, well, we did elevate and exorcise the Pentagon, but I forgot to rotate it. If I'd have rotated it, it would have ended the war.
I think that had consequences.
Yeah. Well.
Didn't you go to jail for boarding the sub?
Yeah, I had a brief... we started putting out a prison newspaper on toilet paper, and they threw us out. You know, they didn't... Because we discovered that they were stealing food from the pantry and selling it, I guess, or taking it home and eating. They were taking big hams away, and so we put that in our prison newspaper, and so that got us out on early.
Was this in Connecticut or that?
Uncasville, Connecticut, yeah.
So who do you think the kill team was working for, the CIA?
Yeah, I think it was CIA, James Angleton. And Richard Helms had to know about it. There are people who claim that the assassin of Robert Kennedy lives in Berkeley now. I have a Google picture of his house. He's got a beautiful little expensive pad in Berkeley. He's very hostile to people who try to approach him and talk about it. He's thought to be the same one that killed Mary Meyer.
Who is she?
So.
And how old is he? He's
got to be old. He's about in his late 70s, I guess. You know. But, if you're on a certain level, you can bump people off, and you yourself are immune from getting bumped off.
You have a nice mention.
The only reason I mentioned Dartmouth as being remote is I had felt that there was some spiritual abuse, and so I called this fellow who was once part of the Moonies here, and he started, after he was deprogrammed by his family, because the only reason I got to reprogram him after 13 years is he was sick. And so while he laid in bed, they brought people. And then he eventually turned against the Moonies or whatever, and he lived here a lot. then he started doing books and helping people get deprogrammed from other things. So they did the first I've ever heard of a spiritual abuse conference, and somehow I was on his email list. So I went down to it. It was pretty phenomenal to meet these people. It wasn't just the Moonies. It was churches, Cape Cod, all over.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't done one since, and I'm really surprised. But he
mm-hmm.
does write books.
Mm-hmm.
And he still lives in Boston.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so I'm wondering if records are there for that. But that was just 3 years ago. Mellinson probably wasn't around. But
no, you know, you can only do
house.
What you can do. You know, there. Especially in this era, if you need like 50 parallel lives to do all the social work you need to do, all the committees you need to take part in, just to keep track of issues, you know, just do it a couple hours a day, you know, going from website to website, it's difficult to stay current. And you have to realize that somebody like Olson, who was a genius, could remember all this stuff and keep it all. But the rest of us mere mortals are what they say, man must be content with limited extent.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Are you working on any projects now?
Yeah, I just finished. I did this 170 page history of Charles Olson and printed up 50, and then since then I've done a history of, I had a bookstore in New York City called the Peace Eye Bookstore, and I've done a similar glyphic history of it, which I just finished. So I don't know, I'm trying to slow down and enjoy my old age. But.
Yeah, how hard are you trying?
He's still in the East Coast, because I knew you when I was at Cooper Union, and you were singing in Tompkins Square Park.
All right.
I can't believe I'm still alive.
Yeah,
So are you. So where are you then?
I live in Woodstock for the last 40 years. So.
New York?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, as Chekhov said, that live in a small town is like a nightmare of contending factions. And I'm sure, he was talking about his little town near Moscow, but Woodstock is just
Moscow,
like, a seething hotbed of rivalry and avarice and greed and bit. So,
not unlike Boston.
Yeah, so I guess. So you only can do what you can do. You know, you can't have anxiety about not being able to do enough. Because if you had 50 parallel lives and you went to 100 meetings a day in each one of the 50 lives, there'd still be a cancer ward.
So you go to that Buddhist ashram and meditate? Or?
Well, no. You know, I've
it's pretty big.
Go out in a blaze of leaflets.
The Kennedy legacy, or Robert Kennedy's legacy, I feel that maybe when you assassinate someone, you're attempting to blot out their impact on the world and what they could have done, history that it would have happened differently. So, but I also think that there's been such damage done to Robert Kennedy and the Kennedys' reputation. Like, I feel I'm from Pennsylvania, and when living in Massachusetts, you just notice, we all know about the idealism, the Camelot, but there's also this like other dark side to the way that people react to the Kennedy family, and
yeah.
I think it's tapping into these like darker forces and energies where, all the different things that you're calling up, like the racism and all these things, and just an example, like I remember when this is another Kennedy, but the Edward Kennedy Institute for the U.S. Senate opened, there were just all these comments that people were writing about hating the Kennedys, and it was really like violent and strong and kind of frankly a little scary. So I think that this sort of the reasons that you are citing are still like totally out there.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of you know, like history is what's happening now too. Like I feel that this gives me a chill because of what I see happening today in America. So, and maybe this person's life does need to be, or legacy needs to be restored in some ways too. So that was incredible. Like sitting here listening to you read, it feels like you're in that place. So the power to do that through your research and files and just the interviews, like the power of being able to get as close as you can to a moment like that, it's amazing. So thank you.
He was I've read all the books too. I have, you know, a couple of hundred Robert Kennedy books. I buy everything. And so I've read The Trash Jobs as well as the accurate ones. He was not perfect. But I think if we don't allow people to grow as spiritual, intellectual people, mm-hmm. and become better people, and I think Robert Kennedy, he just said he just threw the dice in the wind, you know, and he realized that was his time. He had to run for president, and people kept warning him. He'd go to these Hollywood banquets on Sunday, and all these Warren Beatty and, you know, all these fancy Hollywood people would warn him that he was going to be shot, and he'd just say it was up to luck, you know, it was up to chance, it was up to fate, and he had to do it. And they wanted to take his limousines and hide them out at night so that no one could put a bomb under the wheels, but he wouldn't let them do that either. You know, he was taunting the universe. And I just wish, I think the only flaw is he should have worshipped the Warren Commission report. He should have said, oh boy, do I believe in the Warren Commission. I think the Warren Commission is the bee's knees. And, you know, that might have kept him alive.
To me, this, I know exactly what you mean because I read the comments in the Globe, which is a terrible burden.
Well, have you
burden,
read?
But, yeah.
I'm just saying you read all the comment lines on Google. I mean, the right wing has taken over all the threads and you can't read comments.
Yeah, you kind of can't. Although in the Globe, they're a little more local mostly. But the thing is that this kind of work gives me hope. It doesn't chill me. I know it's chilling, but if you read enough bad stuff, you're chilled anyway. because I was one of those people who was a teenager, you know, and I went around knocking on doors for McCarthy, and I thought that Robert Kennedy was a tool of the FBI. It gives me a person in the past to see as an example of change and courage and a force for good and the possibility that someone at that height could actually be a force for good and be brave. And to me, that's really encouraging. I need a past. I need some sign that there have been good, foolish, brave people. Even it's too bad about the not worshipping.
No happy ending there, though. Yeah.
Well, the ending is really, really bad, but, you know, how many people get murdered in America every year?
I Googled the Kennedy by accident this morning. I was looking for a woman named Joan Bennett, so Joan Bennett Kennedy came up, and then this whole string of Kennedys from Joseph Sr. all the way down to the end, and they said there's a curse on the... It started out with this headline, The Curse of the Kennedy. That was what it said.
Well, I've done a lot of biographies. I did I was very close to Allen Ginsberg, extremely close. I mean, he called me and my wife just before he died. And he told me things about his personal life that I decided when I wrote my biography of him that I wasn't going to talk about. You don't, why say everything you know? Well, you know, because, and it's the same way about any person you write about, you find the dark side and the bad side. There's no saint out there.
Why do you think Ginsberg told you those things?
Because he was a blabbermouth. You know, and we were very close. We shared a lot of interests in common, you know, personal freedom, and I was writing a lot of erotic stuff back then, and he always wrote erotic stuff. So we bonded, and we lived close to each other. And, so anyway. There are dark, you know, like I know stuff about Charles Olson that I learned over the years that I learned back then when it happened, but I would never, I don't see any reason that I should put that in any biography. Why? Why tell something just because a voice says tell it, you know? I don't know. I know stuff about almost every person that I've become intimate with that I wouldn't want to spread around.
Maybe that's why they tell you stuff. They know that.
Well, yeah. I don't know. There's no easy answer. So the Kennedys, you know, I mean, I've read all the books about John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Edward Kennedy and the children, you know. They say... You know, there's all this trash, you know. Like if you're a girl, don't get in a car with a Kennedy. That's what the, you know, the, anyway. So, but I think Robert Kennedy wore his truth on his lapel. And he exposed himself to the universe at the end of his life in a noble and glorious way. And he deserved to be president, and 24 or 30,000 young men wouldn't have died in Vietnam. And there would have been more racial harmony, and there would have been, probably would, you know, he would have worked for a universal medical system. I mean, you know, they had all the structure. All these people that served John Kennedy were ready to surge forward and join the team. Guys like Dick Goodwin, who just passed away, he was a wonderful writer. And, you know, he was a top-rank professional government, but also a good writer, but also how to organize. I mean, he worked, anyway, he worked for the State Department. He was, but he was right there with Kennedy, helping him write his final speech, you know. And he just passed away. I regret that.
Maybe they were naive. I mean, because even John Kennedy was in an open car when he got shot in Texas.
Well,
crazy.
No, how did that open car happen? They had the bubble up, and Jim Lehrer of the future NET, you know, the news broadcaster, came up and said to the Secret Service, my office wants an to take the top either off or down. I don't know how they do it. They detach it. So right at the last minute, just before the final caravan, thanks to Jim Lehrer, Kennedy's top was taken off. And then who instructed the driver to slow down to 2 miles an hour for a long time, just while the bullet or the people above and below the triangulation were getting ready to blow his brains out. You know, why did that happen? So... You know.
I mean, those things are what make us not naive.
Yeah. So, look, I don't know. Anyway, I've babbled long enough. I'm grateful that you came.